Brother Lucas's topic today is respite, and he has asked us to read Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 11, which is somewhat difficult to read without singing it. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, 1 through 11. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. He hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. And we'll turn it over to Brother Luke, and once again his topic is respite.
Good morning, everyone. It's good to see everyone here today. Today we're going to talk, or I'd like to speak on respite. And this comes from, you know, the current events and I think a lot of what we've found ourselves in today. And I think none of us would deny that we live in trying times. And while there has always been and will always be contention within the brotherhood, both within and without, and that's will always be until really the return of Jesus. It seems that our days in particular are quite turbulent, and it seems that there's contentions on every side and trials in every direction. And we have not been immune to this. And there has been much controversy in our ecclesia. And, you know, recently we have made a decision, and while that decision was not unanimous, we have reached an opportunity, and we have an opportunity for some peace in our ecclesia. And that's where the term respite comes in. Respite is defined as a delay or cessation for a time, especially of anything distressing or trying, an interval of relief. And today, what I want to do is look at a few individuals from the Bible and examine how they face trials in their life, some of them very severe, but how God provided them a respite, a time of peace, a time of recovery. And from this, number three, how it helped them face future trials that they were to endure. This is important because while we have, in some manner, made a decision, our contending is not over. As long as we live in a permissive society, as long as we contain sin in the flesh, there will be struggles and contending, both within and without. How we use our respite, and I think in a broader sense, how our time of peace, how we use our time in the ecclesia may well determine our overall fate, because this will help us overcome the trials and temptations we face in the future. Will we be discouraged and overcome in future contentions? Or will we be tempered and refreshed and able to maintain the fight against sin until the time of our judgment? Now, the characters we're going to look at today are well known. There's no one that's, you know, a side character or someone that, you know, may not be well known. As a matter of fact, I think all the individuals, everybody knows quite a bit about them. And I don't have, you know, a new spin or a hope to make it an earth-shattering discovery or connection in these lives. But simply, it's to show how God took care of his saints of old, And by implication, we look at how God will take care and provide for us the things that we need in our life. So I have four characters I want to look at. We want to go through these somewhat chronologically. And we're going to start by looking at the man David. And we know David was a man who had great trials in his life. He had, we see many of the examples that he, of the things that he had to suffer through. And specifically, we're going to actually have two events I want to look at in his life. And the first one begins when David was a relatively young man, when he was on the run from Saul. We know he had been anointed king. He had done much to help Saul, but Saul's jealousy made it such that David could not safely stay really within a normal life, but he had to flee from Saul. And for a good portion of his young life, and as he matured, he was on the run from Saul, traveling from place to place, trying to maintain the group of people that was with him, provide for them, but also stay away from Saul and preserve his life. And what we want to look at is in, let's turn to 1 Samuel 26. We're going to look at verses 1 through 4. At this point, you know, David had probably been many years on the run, many years hiding and avoiding Saul, but at the same time trying to do what was right amongst his brethren, to try to help the nation in any way he could. So while he was, you know, public enemy number one from Saul's, in Saul's eyes, you know, David was very much a member of the nation of Israel and was trying to do that which was right. He wasn't an outlaw. He wasn't a bandit, you know, out to make a name or a living for himself, but he was trying to survive. And we see oftentimes that, and you know, not unique to David, but in David's life, you know, the good he did was not returned. And we see this, we look at chapter 26, in the first four verses we read, "And the Ziphites came unto Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakkelah, which is before Jeshimon? Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul pitched in the hill of Hakkaliah, which is before Jeshimon, by the way. But David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul was come in very deed." So here we see that he is in a tight position. Saul has come with an army of 3,000 men to hunt David down. And if you continue to read the chapter, we see that, you know, David does what's right. He confronts Saul. You know, he goes in at night, steals a cruse of water and a portion of his garment. He confronts Saul at a safe distance, say, you know, "The Lord put you in my hand, and yet I spared your life." There appears to be some restitution with Saul. Saul realizes that he has behaved improperly and leaves. But look at but David is not quite convinced. And we look at 1 Samuel, the next chapter, and look at the first seven verses. And David said in his heart, this is chapter 27, beginning at verse 1, "I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, and Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand. And David arose, and he passed over with the 600 men that were with him into Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife. And was told Saul that David was fled to Gath, and he sought him no more again for him. And David said to Achish, if I have now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country, that I may dwell there, for why should thy servant dwell in the royal city with thee? Then Achish gave him Ziklag that day, wherefore Ziklag pertaineth unto the kings of Judah unto this day. And the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months." David, I think, really needed a time of rest to recover from the stresses of continual pursuit. He had lived for many years, never knowing when the next attack would come, who he could trust, you know, where he would provide food for 600 individuals. And that was a large number. So by turning and fleeing to the Philistines and living in Ziklag, this provided David with an opportunity to live a, what we might call a normal life. He was no longer being pursued. He could focus his attention and live and worry about other events of his life. And we also know that while in this, during this time, this year and 4 months when he was living in Ziklag, he wasn't idle. He just didn't sit there doing nothing, but used this time to attack Israel's enemies in the south country. These were nations and peoples that should have been taken care of by the Israelites in their past, but due to the weakness and the and really the turbulence of the time through the time of the judges had never been addressed. And so many of these nations which God had commanded Israel to exterminate or to drive out had stayed and flourished in some of the extremities of the land of Israel. And David used this time with his men to make raiding bands on it and to really to drive them out. And we can see from the course of history that would set him up for when he became king. Some of these issues that he may have had to face then were taken care of. Now we know that this time in the Philistines' country in Ziklag was temporary. He wasn't to live there the rest of his days. And if we look at really chapters 1 through 4 of 2 Samuel, which we're not going to read, we see David face some pretty great trials afterwards. Because even after Saul died and the men of Judah made David king, he faced some tough situations because there were many years of civil war and David had to unite the kingdom under his rule. He had to show himself to be a worthy king. He had to show the people that he was a strong leader and show the people that he did not bear hostility towards any who may have sided with Saul. It would have been a very trying time. It would have taken a great amount of cunning and a great amount of skill and diplomacy to win the nation to his cause. He had to end with the nation of Judah. That was his natural family. But it would take a great deal of really diplomacy and a great deal of effort to win the nation. And I really believe that this time that he had in Ziklag allowed him to prepare himself for that. He was able to focus his attention on matters to this regards rather than matters of pure survival. So I believe that he used this time to prepare himself for the future. Staying with David, we're going to fast forward now many years. And as an older man, David faced another trial, another test of his faith. And this, we want to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 15. We see that Absalom, his own son, had organized a coup against his father and was making moves to take the throne forcefully from him. Let's look at 2 Samuel 15, verses 13 through 18. And there came a messenger to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom." And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword." And the king's servant said unto the king, "Behold, thy servants are ready to do whatsoever my lord the king shall appoint." And the king went forth and all his household after him. And the king left 10 women which were concubines to keep the house. And the king went forth and all the people after him and tarried in a place that was far off. And all his servants passed on beside him, and all the Kirathites and the Pelethites, all the Gittites, 600 men which came after him from Gath, passed on before the king. David faced a great trial, and he decides that in order to spare the land from unnecessary war, he would flee and leave the city and leave his situation in the hand of God. Now, as we read, this would have been, you know, an emotionally draining, and I don't know if I could ever, you know, or any of us could be in a similar situation, possibly, but, you know, it would have been emotionally and I think spiritually also very trying. And yet, even in this time of great distress, God provides a respite for David. And we see in the following, or in this chapter, in the following chapters, two incidents where God provides a measure of relief for David in this time of great trial. The first is in verses 32 through 34 of the same chapter. We read, "And it came to pass that when David was come to the top of the mount where he worshipped God, behold, Hushai, the Archite came to meet him with his coat rent and earth upon his head, and to whom David said, If thou passest on with me, then thou shalt be a burden unto me. But if thou return to the city, and say to Absalom, I will be thy servant, O king, as I have been thy father's servant hitherto, so will I now also be thy servant. Then mayest thou for me defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. God sent to David a measure of respite, or respite, and that of his friend Hushai. He was a skilled counselor and one who could and would successfully steer the counsel of Absalom to that which would be beneficial to David. And I think David would have recognized this. This was not someone he had sent for, someone that was with him when he left Jerusalem, but someone who had heard of David's plight, who had heard of the trials and with great sadness heard that David was leaving and came to meet David to strengthen him any way he could. I would think that, you know, this was something that David would take great heart of. Additionally to this, as David makes his flight and continues his exodus from the city to a place where he could be safe, we see in chapter 17, 2 Samuel 17, a further respite provided by God, just as I think Hushai would have provided mental health and mental peace of mind to David. We see that God did not forsake his physical needs also, because in verses 27 through 29, we see how God provides the natural things for David as well. We read, As it came to pass when David was come to Mahanaim, that Shobai, the son of Nahash, of Rabbah, of the children of Ammon, and Maker, the son of Amiel, of Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite of Rogalim, brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour and parched corn and beans and lentils and parched pulse and honey and butter and sheep and cheese of kine for David and for the people that were with him to eat. For they said, The people is hungry and weary and thirsty in this wilderness. God providentially provided allies for David as well, who provided for his natural needs. They provided to David a cup of cold water, as it were, refreshing their spirits. And I think to David, the spiritual man, showed that God had not forsaken him. Even this time of great distress, he was provided for. These individuals allowed him to forego, once again, like in Ziklag, I would say, the need for providing natural provisions. He didn't have to worry about where their food was going to come from. He didn't have that stress on him. And as such, he could prepare himself and the people for the events that were to come. And we know that there were significant future trials for David in regards to this issue. In the next chapters, chapter 18 and 19, David and his men have to fight a second civil war to reunite the kingdom under the rightful reign of David. And as David returned from this, we know that David and his men were successful. They defeated the forces and the army of Absalom, you know, by a great rout. And David was returned to power. And upon his return, David had to execute many judgments against people who may have slighted him or been against him in this time of his exile. And I think God's support for him, when David was at his most vulnerable and at his most needy, helped him provide righteous judgment when he was in a position to do so. He realized that everything he received had come from God. He was dependent on God for his needs, and God provided for him. And so when we look, it would have helped him when he looked and judged these individuals who had slighted him personally. He would have realized that it was not from his hand, it was not from David's power that he was sustained, but from that, from God. And I think that would have put him in a more righteous mentality when passing these judgments. It helped him to be the ruler that the kingdom of Israel needed, one who ruled in the light of God, in God's judgments. And as we've read for, you know, the last couple weeks, you know, close to a month and a half, from Psalm 119, you know, those concepts that David wrote about in his life, he was able to portray in his life, thanks, I think, in a big part, to the provision that God had made for him when he was most needy. He was able to refresh himself naturally so he could focus on spiritual things. The next individual we want to look at was the prophet Elijah. Elijah himself was a man of action, and he faced many trials. And the one in particular that always stands out to me is his interactions with Jezebel and Elijah, or sorry, with Ahab. And like many individuals, many, many good things stick out about Elijah. He is a man of faith, a man of action, one who was convicted in his love and action for God. But at the same time, oftentimes, at least for me, I focus on a time of his weakness, a time when he tripped a little. And we see God's provision for Elijah in here and providing him a moment of respite to perfect him and to keep him from falling entirely. So we look at 1 Kings 19. We look at the first three verses. This takes place just after his confronting the prophets of Baal. We know that it was a miraculous show of power. Elijah demonstrated without a doubt that God was the true God. Yahweh was the true God in Israel, that Baal was nothing. A seemingly great victory and a spiritual victory for the people. He put to death the prophets of Baal. The people executed them. But immediately after this, we see he receives a message. So 1 Kings 19, 1 through 3. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and withal how he had slain the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as one of them by tomorrow about this time. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belonged to Jerusalem, or to Judah, and left his servants there. And we know that he didn't stay in Beersheba, but eventually would go all the way down to Mount Horeb. And here he receives a respite from God. He receives a help, a strengthening amidst a time of trial. And we see this in 1 Kings 19, at the end of the chapter, verses 15 through 18. We read, and the Lord said to him, go return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when thou comest to anoint Hazael to be king, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu the son of Nimshi shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees of which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. Despite Elijah's thought that he was the only one left in Israel faithful to God, God reassured him that things were going according to his plan. God provided Elijah with three individuals that would exact judgments and his vindication upon that wicked family of Ahab. And on top of this, there was at least 7,000 individuals. There was a remnant in Israel who had not worshipped Baal. Elijah was not the only one left. God strengthens him. In this moment, we read that he was 40 days in this sojourning down to Horeb and back. And in this time, God provided Elijah the things that he needed and Elijah needed to strengthen him, to be able to return and continue the contending for the faith that he had before him. And we know that Elijah's contending and his actions were not done at this point. In 1 Kings 21 and in 2 Kings 1 and 2, we see Elijah continues to minister as a prophet in Israel. The difference is, though, he is no longer afraid of what Jezebel could do to him. He was no longer concerned what the power that man may hold over him. He continued steadfastly and unflinchingly opposed the spiritual wickedness in the midst of the nation, leading those people, being an example to those 7,000 through both word and example of how to live a life pleasing to God. And if you look at the example, he comes in the case of Naboth's vineyard. He comes boldly to Ahab and tells him, you've done wickedly. There's going to be great punishments against you. When Ahab's son seeks Elijah's life for giving him a bad report saying that you are going to die and not recover, we don't see Elijah fleeing, but we see him sitting in the midst of the country where all men know to find him and having faith that God will provide for him and provide him safety. And this would have been, I think, a great example to those individuals in the land. Because afterwards, after Elijah's day, what do we see? We see Elisha, a great type. We see the school of the prophets, which weren't mentioned before. I think many of these individuals would have taken an example from Elijah and been strengthened to follow God's commandments. We next want to turn our attention to another prophet, this time a prophet of Judah. We're going to look at Jeremiah. And Jeremiah, we see trial after trial, suffering after suffering. But particularly in this regard, we want to take a look at an event that happened at the very end of the kingdom of Judah. And we want to look at Jeremiah chapter 38. So we'll turn to Jeremiah 38. We want to look at the first five verses. Here we see Jeremiah, in this case, facing a great trial, and a trial that would have put him in mortal danger, a very physical trial. We read, "Then Shephatiah the son of Matan, and Gedaliah the son of Pashur, and Jukal the son of Shelemiah, and Pashur the son of Malchiah, heard the words that Jeremiah had spoken unto all the people, saying, Thus saith the Lord, He that remaineth in this city shall die by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. But he that goeth forth to the Chaldeans shall live, for he shall have his life for a prey, and shall live. Thus saith the Lord, this city shall surely be given into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which shall take it. Therefore the princes said unto the king, We beseech thee, let this man be put to death, for thus he weakeneth the hands of the men of war that remain in the city, and the hands of all the people, in speaking such words unto them, for this man seeketh not the welfare of this people, but the hurt. Then Zedekiah the king said, Behold, he is in your hand, for the king is not he that can do anything against you." So after many years of condemning the prophets, condemning through prophecies and rebukes, Jeremiah had been wrongfully accused of treason. He had been put in jail, and the prince of the land used the words of his prophecy as means to execute him, to put him to death. And instead of being, put to death quickly, they leave him, really, we might say, to rot in the abandoned sewers of the palace. It's called the dungeon, but it was, probably not much more than where the sewers were, all the, basically latrines with empty, would have been a very nasty place. And Jeremiah was essentially left there to die of starvation, of disease. He was left there and to be forgotten. Truly a very great trial. From a physical standpoint, maybe one of the darkest hours of Jeremiah's life, a great trial he faced. And yet, from this seemingly dark position, this great trial, God provides a respite for Jeremiah. If we look further on in the chapter, we see that Jeremiah is actually saved by faithful members of Zedekiah's palace, some of the servants, when the eunuchs comes and rescues Jeremiah, and he is put back in what would be the normal jail. And Jeremiah is entreated by Zedekiah, and through this entreaty, he guarantees Jeremiah's safety, that Jeremiah would not be returned to the dungeons or where he had previously been, but that he would be left in just the normal jail. We look at this. This is verses 24 through 28. "Then said Zedekiah unto Jeremiah, Let no man know of these words, and thou shalt not die. But if the princes hear that I have talked with thee, and they come unto thee, and say unto thee, Declare unto us now what thou hast said unto the king, hide it not from us, and we will not put thee to death, also what the king said unto thee, then thou shalt say unto them, I presented my supplication before the king, that he would not cause me to return to Jonathan's house to die there. Then came all the princes unto Jeremiah and asked him, and he told them according to all these words, so that that the king had commanded. So they left off speaking with him, for the matter was not perceived. So Jeremiah abode in the court of the prison until the day that Jerusalem was taken, and he was there when Jerusalem was taken." We see that God provided Jeremiah peace. He was stay in the jail until the day that Jerusalem was taken. While this may not have seemed a great blessing, I believe that Jeremiah would have received at least a portion of food, something that was not to be was not taken or was not a guarantee during the siege. And for a moment of time, his life was spared. He did not have to face against the jealous princes that were seeking to end his life. He was afforded a measure of protection there. And as such, Jeremiah would be able to maintain in prayer, possibly receive those who had been his allies. And as such, it would strengthen him for the next great trial that Jeremiah would face. For when we look in Jeremiah chapters 39 through 43, Jeremiah was given an opportunity. When the city was taken, he was presented with a proposition from the general of the army that he could either stay with the people, he could return to Babylon and be taken care of. Basically, Jeremiah had his opportunity. What he wanted to do, it would be granted to him. He would be looked after. And Jeremiah chose to remain with the remnant of Judah in the land. He attempted to provide a spiritual guidance to a group of individuals who were overall stiff-necked and rebellious. He was there to provide them God's word. He traveled with these people down to Egypt, even though he knew it was a doomed expedition. God had told him that is not what to do. But through this, I believe, through partially through the strength he was given through this time of relative peace in his life, he chose to stay with the people and try to provide the guidance, even though it was a challenging and really a hopeless situation. We're not told any more about Jeremiah after the people left to Egypt, although I think history, profane history and tradition says that he was eventually stoned or killed by the Jews in Egypt. So, you know, he would have great trials in the future. Yet, I believe that this time of peace that he had enabled him to decide to help the people and do what he could in the time allotted him. The final individual we want to take a look at is the Apostle Paul. And we know that Paul faced many trials and had much struggle throughout his life. And specifically, we want to look towards the end of the book of Acts and his return to Jerusalem. And this is detailed in chapters 21 through 26, so we don't have the time to read each of these. But if we take an overall really summary of what happened, befell Paul in these chapters, we see that he faced great challenges from his brother, or from his natural brethren, the Jews. He returned to Jerusalem, and in trying to pay vows in the temple, he was accosted by the Jews and almost killed. He was, you know, a mob broke out and he was in danger of being trampled or beaten to death by a group of angry Jews within the temple. From that, he was detained by the Roman authorities, and he was kept really in prison or in a jail under guard in Jerusalem, where not content with being held by the Romans, a group of Jews plot to end his life, to murder by murdering Paul. And you know, this through God's protection, this plot is known, and he is moved from Jerusalem up to Caesarea, and thus escapes his life out of Jerusalem. Yet he is held in prison for an extended period of time in Caesarea before he appeals to Caesar, and by that would be escorted to Rome as a prisoner. So over the space of however long, Paul faced trial after trial after trial from his brethren. A man who was used to, you know, traveling the countryside, visiting city to city, preaching the gospel, found himself a prisoner, someone who could not come and go as he wanted, someone that was under lock and key, as it were, and was his life was constantly in danger. And yet we see from this, God would provide a respite. God's law, or God's plan and purpose, was being fulfilled through Paul. We can look at the very end of the book of Acts, Acts chapter 28. We see this time given to Paul to really, I think, refresh himself, to work unmolested by those who would want to harm him. In Acts 28, we read verses 30 through 31, "And Paul dwelt 2 whole years in his own hired house and received all that came into him, preaching the kingdom of God and teaching those things which concern the Lord Jesus Christ with all confidence, no man forbidding him." So we see for nearly 2 years, Paul lived in Rome under house arrest. But at this time, he was allotted the freedom to receive to receive guests and preach the gospel at his discretion. While he was a prisoner, while he was living under house arrest, this was actually to his benefit. For we see that under Roman protection, he could do as he wished. He was not going to be under the, you know, he didn't have to worry about attack from, I think, Jewish people, or, you know, the scribes and the Pharisees, or the Jewish leaders who would want to harm Paul. You know, he was offered a measure of protection by the Roman guards that watched over him. And we know that he lived this way in Rome for this 2 years, and eventually he was acquitted and set free. Now, while we don't read any more of his actual work in the Acts, from other chapters of the Bible, especially, I think, or books of the Bible, especially 2 Timothy, we see that Paul's trials and contention were not done at this point. But after he was set free, Paul continued to preach the gospel and strengthen the ecclesias in an era when persecutions arose from both Jew and Roman and apostate brethren. We know Paul was eventually rearrested, and this time he was not set free, but was condemned to death. But I think in many parts by the strength and by the peace allotted him in the times when he was a prisoner in Rome at the end of Acts, he was able to continue the fight that he was given. And the greatest thing that Paul wrote and about himself is in the end of 2 Timothy, where under divine inspiration, he was able to write an approval of his life's work to Timothy and leave his example as that of something to be emulated by his companion. So we see, I think, in many ways, the safety and protection and the peace that Paul had in Rome allowed him and strengthened him to continue through the rest of his life. So, looking at each of these individuals as a whole and the situations they faced, they were various, they varied. But each of these individuals faced trials in their life, many physical, many life-threatening. But I think each of them had trials of their faith as well. And in the midst of these trials that they faced, God prepared a respite for them. He provided them a time of reprieve and recovery where they could strengthen themselves. Now, in some of these cases, I want to make a note that the respite was by their own actions, taken on their own accord. I think we look at David when he flees to the Philistines, to Ziklag, and to Elijah when he flees to Horeb. There would be consequences to these actions. David was put in a very compromising position when the Philistines went to face Saul's army. David was called to march with the Philistine forces. Now, I don't believe David would have ever fought against Saul. He probably would have turned against the Philistines if given the opportunity to try to prove his honor and his worth to Saul. But he was put in a very compromising position. And even when being discharged from the army, he finds that all the family and the women that were left behind had been taken by some of the bands of the marauders that he had been fighting. And, you know, through divine protection and divine guidance, he was able to recover them all. But, you know, it was a very compromising, a very trying position that David found himself in. Once again, and I would say contrast that to David's second respite that God gave him when he flees from Absalom, where, you know, it's God providing everything from David. It wasn't David's decision to go and ask for help, but God provided for those. And we see that I think David puts his full faith in God in that second example we looked at, and things came out a little bit better for him. We can look at Elijah also. Elijah flees. He's worried for his life. And in many ways, I think, you know, he kind of turns his back on the commission that God had given him. And while God was merciful to him, Elijah does receive a rebuke at Mount Horeb, as well as strengthening. God's message to him, his first message was, Elijah, what are you doing here? Why aren't you, you know, strengthening the Israelites as you should be? In both cases, though, you know, the outcome of it was that these individuals were strengthened by it. They repented of any errors they may have held and were able to return and to provide the actions necessary to strengthen the nations. We also want to note that in many conditions, this respite that God gave them was not the most ideal situation as appeals as appealing to the flesh. Jeremiah and Paul were essentially prisoners, or, you know, not essentially, they were prisoners. Jeremiah, in particular, was left in a prison. He was locked up. He couldn't go out. He was, you know, he was like in a jail cell, I think, if we think of it. Paul had a little bit more freedom, but he was still a prisoner under the Roman authorities. He, you know, he had, most likely had a guard that was chained to him 24/7 until he was acquitted. We look at Elijah. You know, Elijah's condition after God's strengthened him was he had to return to a nation that, while there was a remnant that was faithful, as a whole, that nation was steeped in idolatry, and both Baal worship, which was particularly odious, but also the idolatry set up by Jeroboam, a nation that was full of apostasy. So, you know, it wasn't like Elijah was stepping back into a spiritually strong environment, but yet that was where God needed him to be, and through God's provision, he was faithful. He was able to deal with that situation and be a good example. And in each of these situations, though, while they may not come to a great situation, the time that was allotted to them as a time of recovery, they used wisely. They prepared themselves for the future trials. Sometimes, I think in the case of Elijah, it was just a word of encouragement, an acknowledgement from God that he was doing the right thing and that he was not alone. I think you look at individuals like David. He was provided, you know, the natural things that he needed so he could focus on spiritual matters, on being the king and the leader he needed to be. Same thing with Paul. He was able to write, you know, the epistle strengthening the brethren around the Roman Empire from Rome, unmolested, not having to worry about being, you know, attacked by an angry mob and fleeing from city to city. Each of these individuals used the time given them wisely, and as a such, they were prepared for the future contentions that presented themselves, you know, after they returned to their active duty. And when we look at that, I think we can take a lesson for this, because we will face challenges in the future. This is inevitable. Until the abolishment of sin, there will always be contention. But we can use this time, and I think especially the time we have with our brothers and sisters here in the Ecclesia, to strengthen ourselves, to take solace in the fact that we know that God knows what we need to be successful. And I think when we look at that, that's both from a personal level. He knows what I need in particular. He knows what you need in particular. But also from an Ecclesia level as a whole, as a light stand, he knows what we need in Orlando to be successful. And he also knows our individual limits. He knows what we are able to bear and will not push us further than that. It's a famous, and everybody should know it. You look at 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12, where you read, maybe it's 2 Corinthians 10, 12. Hold on. I hate it when I do that. Wrong verse. Actually, it's 2 Corinthians 10, verse 13. Sorry. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. God knows what we need. He won't try us harder than what we will. And we also know that what we face is not unique. You know, we may be in a particular trying time, but the individual trials we face, individually and collectively, are not unique. We read from Ecclesiastes earlier, and if we turn to the first chapter in Ecclesiastes, Solomon leaves us a message in verse 9, chapter 1, verse 9. The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. The Ecclesia in days past have faced similar trials. And through those trials, God has always preserved a remnant. We know from this that success is possible. We can successfully contend. And I think we look at that. We know, just I think as Elijah needed that boost, we can look at that and say, you know, success and you know, success is possible. God has not put us in an unwinnable situation. Our situation in regards to this may not, and I'd say probably will not, be easy, but victory is possible. Let's look at Romans chapter 8, verses 35 through 37. Read, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? As it is written, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. We can overcome. And if we use the time provided for us wisely, if we build each other up, we will be able to overcome. Like at Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 and 6. Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. So that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear what man shall do to me. And I think when we look at that, we boldly say, we can boldly come and provide our distresses to God. We can ask him for help and we come to him, and we're left with a very comforting message through Christ in John 6, verse 37. There we read, all that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out. If we strengthen ourselves in this time, come to Jesus, you know, pray to him for strength and for help in the trials that we face, you know, we will be accepted. He will hear our prayer and petition and will give us those things we needed, just as the faithful of old received those things. And tying it all up and completing it, let's turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And now, when we look at this, this is a famous chapter, and it sets a series of dualities. There's a time for everything, but at the end, I think I take great strength in verse 11. We may see, you know, we may question what's going on. We may have these trials. We may feel weak. We may feel despondent, but we do know that there is a time for everything, and what we are be given is what's best for us. And we read in verse 11, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has set the world in their hearts so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I think if we keep this mind and heart, it should give us strength. You know, everything will be beautiful in its time. As we fight, as we struggle, as we contend, we may question, you know, why is this going on? You know, how it says that no man can find out the work that God maketh. You know, we may question it from the here and now, but if we take a step back and look and consider these verses, you know, that there's a time for everything, we will see that there is a great beauty in what God has set about. And that great beauty is that he is perfecting each and every one of us, trying us, you know, as a stone is rolled in the river, taking off the rough edges and forming us to be the servants that we need to be, so that when his son does return, we might all be found acceptable to stand before him. So let us be encouraged by this. Let us be strong. And let us use the time that we have wisely so that we may be accounted worthy to be numbered in that company in the kingdom age. Thank you.
Thank you for your words of comfort and respite, and where we can find those. We'll continue with our memorial service and sing together hymn number 110. The true Messiah now appears, the types are all withdrawn. So fly the shadows and the stars before the rising dawn. Hymn number 110. The Orlando Ecclesia's basis of fellowship is exclusively the unamended statement of faith, and we welcome those who believe and adhere to those doctrines and commandments stated therein. In Genesis 3:21, we read, "Unto Adam also and to his wife did the Lord God make coats of skins and clothe them." This provision of Yahweh is explicitly tied to the work of Christ. Over one of the places is in Revelation chapter 13 in the first 8 verses. In the first parts of this chapter of the Apocalypse, we receive information about the rise of the prophetic beasts of the sea and the land and their development and what they would do to challenge the believer. We read, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was likened to a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast, and who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, and his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds, and tongues, and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, those whose names are not written in the book of the life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world." So the work that was provided by this Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world, would be at odds with this power of the world and of sin in perpetuity, until one or the other be destroyed. How could a penalty that had specific and personal reference to Adam and Eve, that being the sin in the garden, be satisfied by the death of animals? It could not, in a permanent sense. Alone and of itself, the blood of bulls and goats truly could not take away sin. It was exhortive, it was exemplary, but it was insufficient. Throughout Scripture, the value and efficacy of animal sacrifice is fully dependent upon understanding the close association to the sacrifice of the Messiah. It is beautiful that the sentence of death prescribed on the first transgressors would be mitigated by the sacrificial role of the Messiah many years yet to come. Thousands of years before Christ's birth and prior to the formation of the world, the redemptive plan of Yahweh was prepared and placed in motion, as we know from John chapter 1. When Messiah was cut off from the living, according to Yahweh's will, the significance of animal sacrifice was finally fully ratified. In the way of the Tree of Life, we read, "The sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ is the great redemptive principle, first revealed in Eden, by which flesh can escape from the consequences of sin and the certainty of the death which follows from transgression. Adam and Eve were the first beneficiaries of this manifestation of divine mercy." The transgression and Yahweh's provision of mercy in the garden, coupled with the death of Christ, bring us a beautiful image. Please turn to Revelation chapter 4. In his closing words, Brother Luke spoke about this group, this picture of the redeemed together with Christ in full spirit manifestation of Yahweh is the ultimate hope of the believer currently subject to sinful flesh, the ultimate respite, and is made potential for us through him as we remember today. "After this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was, as it were, of a trumpet talking with me, which said, Come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter. And immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat upon the throne. And he that sat was to look upon like a jasper and a sardine stone, and there was a rainbow round about the throne in sight, like unto an emerald. And round about the throne were 40 and 20 seats, and upon the seats I saw 4 and 20 elders sitting, clothed in white raiment, and they had on their heads crowns of gold." we would add here, the 12 sons of the apostles and the 12 sons of Israel. And out of the throne proceeded lightnings and thunderings and voices, and there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne there was a sea of glass like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were four living ones full of eyes before and behind. And the first was like a lion, and the second like a calf, and the third had a face as a man, and the fourth like a flying eagle. And the four living ones had each of them six wings about him, and they were full of eyes within, and they rest not day and night, saying, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, which was and is to come. And when those living ones gave glory and honor and thanks to him that sat on the throne, who liveth forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him that sat on the throne, and worship him that liveth forever and ever, and cast their crowns before the throne, saying, Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. It is of this spiritual and beautiful multitude that we seek to remember Christ today in perpetuity, for he indeed will be manifest among this group, the rainbowed angel of believers, who will represent the interest of Yahweh in the earth, led by the captain of their salvation, and finally to, at one future date, put an end, finally, to the influence of the serpent. Turn with me, please, to Matthew chapter 26. And we'll read the account of the memorials from starting at verse 26. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it and brake it and gave it to the disciples and said, Take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, Drink ye all of it, for this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. This time I'd like to ask Brother Mac to come up and give a prayer for the bread. Well, now ask Brother Sid to offer a word of thanksgiving for the wine. Our closing hymn today, the conclusion of our service, will be 209. Fight the good fight with all thy might. Christ is thy strength and Christ thy right. Lay hold on life and it shall be thy joy and crown eternally. Hymn number 209. And Brother Bill Rott is going to offer a word of closing prayer for us. So as a reminder, pick up the new directories in the back. $5 in the collection box.